Uploading. Tsunami Black Hole Megamix 2K3, now.
The fate of the whole world is in my hands.
You foolish man. I am a Jito Ryo master. Allow me to reunite you with your ancestors.
On the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your Prom Tom host, Thomas Prom Tom Mattis. And on this episode, we continue Etchy Month. That's right, everybody's favorite offensive month is continuing here on the network. As on this episode, I review the 2010 wonderful anime, Cat Planet Cuties. Well, actually, it has a different name. Abaso no Ike is something along the lines. Abaso something and then Bombshells from the Sky. Which I guess isn't much better of a name than Cat Planet Cuties, that Funimation's giving it. But, yeah, for whatever reason, Bombshells from the Sky sounds okay to me. Cat Planet Cuties sounds like a horrible, cheesy title given to a low-class H anime brought over by an American H anime dub company. That's about the only thing I hate about this title. Everything else, I like. But, yeah, Cat Planet Cuties. This came out in 2010. It was part of a long list of many different animes, of many different genres that, again, solidified 2010 as the sort of rebirth of anime popularity, or the possibility of anime popularity, as I see it, and really the rebounding of the anime industry of putting good quality titles out. Because pretty much since then, the past 3 years, you know, if you include 2010 in that, there's been tons of good stuff coming out of Japan. And a lot of it making it over to America. But with that all being said, let's get right into our review of this fun, action-packed adventure comedy. Let's start off with cast and synopsis, since we have no emails or comments to talk about. First, cast. Aaron Dismuke plays Kyo Katsuku. Tia Ballard plays Eris. You know, we probably remember Tia as, you know, Cusco from, you know, Zachary. Monica Rial, who we also probably remember from Sekiri as the motherly figure in the house, plays Ali Futua. Brittany Kabowski plays Minami Kijo. Martha Harms plays Maki Ikatsu. The legendary Lucid Christian plays Antonia. Stacy Moon plays Coin. Colleen Klinkenbeard plays Jonas. Jamie Marchi makes an appearance as Jack. And Sunny Strait, the legendary Sunny Strait, plays Yuichi Miyagi. Synopsis. Kyo is just your average high school Japanese boy who's at a family celebration celebrating his grandfather's anniversary because it's been 1 year since he died. When at the party, he meets a girl that looks like she has like cosplay cat ears and a cat tail and everything and is in a weird outfit. But eventually, getting drunk and passing out, he finds himself, not quickly, in his own bed with her curled up beside him. Of course, this leads to everything you expect, and as it turns out, she turns to be a real alien coming from the planet of Catania and has been sent to Earth to form diplomatic relations. Alongside Kyo's friends, Aoi, who is known as Charmed Aoi, a secret super secret agent for the Japanese immigration bureau, and Minami, who's trying to try to be with the CIA, they eventually form a Catarian embassy to form diplomatic relations with Earth. If only they will survive the many different government agencies trying to get them, the super secret cat cults that want to celebrate them, the Dogarians that want to stop them, and of course each other as, Ares goes in heat. All this and more on Cat Planet Cutious. So with that being said, let's get right into our review of Cat Planet Cuties. Welcome back, and let's get right into it. As we usually do, let's start with music, and of course, let's talk about those opening and closing themes. And I love the opening theme. I'm mixed on the closing themes. I guess since I'm mixed on the closing theme, let me start out with those. They seem fairly typical. And here's the interesting thing. A lot of stuff in this anime, any other year... Maybe I shouldn't say any other year, but I guess the way it does it here, a lot of stuff that seems fairly typical, it's done really, really well. So I'll get to more of that. But, this is one of those rare cases in this anime where doing something fairly typical doesn't work. Here you have sort of these very soft, very sort of, I don't want to say folklorist, because there really isn't anything folklorist, but sort of soft, slow Japanese pop songs as... the closings, and they're okay, but, it's to the point to where I don't have much to say. They really don't catch me. I find myself skipping through the closing theme, getting to the, episode preview, and pretty much the next episode. It's really the only thing I can really say I don't like about this anime, is the closing theme. It really is. I pretty much love everything else about this anime, which probably makes the review... it's significant now, because now you know I like this anime. But yeah, it's just... they never seemed interesting. There was nothing wrong about them. And considering what the ending animation was and what they were going for with the animation, it fit. It just never caught my eye. And I just felt bored with it. Now, the opening, on the other hand, that's a different story. You know, you were hearing the opening just a couple seconds ago. And, yeah, or at least about a minute ago, probably, is more likely. But, yeah, it's just this very fun, very poppy, sort of definitely fits the theme of Okinawan, which is sort of the location of this anime, primarily. They do go to Tokyo, but again, you know, Kyo's home is in Okinawa, and that's where the embassy gets set up. But yeah, definitely this sort of very fun, sort of summer-esque, because a lot of this story actually takes place in summer, with the exception of maybe the last three episodes. But spring and summer, you know, sort of that summer feel of Okinawa, definitely you get those feelings in this song. You also get feelings of sort of the pop culture artifact that is of this anime. You know, this anime, it really is, and it was something I was kind of stumbled over earlier because I wanted to say it, but couldn't find the right place to say it in this, starting to talk about in this episode. But this anime is a celebration of pop culture, as we'll talk about more later. And because of that, you know, you definitely get a feel in the opening, you know, where Aoi and, you know, Manami, you know, they come in, one's blue, one's red, you know, you definitely get this feel, sort of classic, sort of anime opening to that stuff. So those are references on themselves. But yeah, it's just this great sort of pop, joyful feel song. It's very unique. I love the song. I love, the lyrics are catchy. If you read the Japanese lyrics, they're very catchy. And it just fits, again, that whole sort of, it's almost American in a way, if you think about it. Which is kind of funny, because there is a whole lot of American pop culture references and sort of American jokes in this anime. You know, I mentioned Jack earlier, because she has quite a number of lines to be significant. Even though she doesn't directly involve herself with the group. But Jack is really pretty much an entire stereotype of what Japanese think American women look like. But she's big, she's very tall, she's blonde, she is busty. She's in a cowboy hat, halter top, shorty shorts, and she's in a Chevrolet Corvette Stingray. She's a Texan, basically. Which, let's be honest, Texans a lot of times get used as sort of the stereotypical American, for better or for worse. Yeah. We'll probably get more into her design in character designs, but yeah, just this whole song is just joyful, it's poppy, and I love it. And you know what, more importantly, it does what it needs to do. It gets me exactly into the anime. I love watching the opening theme, because I just love listening to the opening theme, and it gets me right into the anime. And the rest of the score of the show is pretty good. Again, it's pretty standard for what an anime like this would have. But they are very fun tunes. I love sort of the Assistroid theme. That's just a very playful, fun tune that really catches my ear. The sort of action music, again, sort of that classic action movie music, again, also catches my ear. But really the song I absolutely love in this series is sort of an insert song, and it's used in Episode 9, which, in Episode 9, the very first Assistroid that Kat Tarian ever created, Lardy, comes to Earth to complete a wish before basically she's put offline. Because, you know, as they tell in the story, you know, when Assistroid Master dies, and again, maybe I should explain what Assistroid is. In the show, they have these little sort of robots called Assistroids. You know, the cats, the Catarians, their Assistroids are more, look like little cat people. The Dogarians ones look like little dogs. But Assistroids are basically sort of these artificial intelligence robots that, you know, help them do things. Lottery, being the very first Assistroid, is actually bigger and looks more human. She looks more like one of them. She's only recently found, but, you know, she's been alive for pretty much, I think they sort of, like, say maybe 70 years or something like that, or a couple hundred. Well, I know that's a very wide range to say, because I can't remember off the top of my head, because it wasn't something I put into my notes. But anyways, you know, she comes to Earth to basically see the stars on Earth, you know, complete her master's wish before she gets taken offline. And as such, she sings this song, you know, The Lonely Spaceman. And it's sort of the theme of that episode of, you know, this song that everybody keeps talking about that sort of perfectly captures what it means to be, you know, a space person and be in space. And, you know, the aliens, they keep saying, you know, how amazing is that the Earthlings who haven't been this deep in space are able to capture it. This feeling about being in space. And it's it's a one. In fact, you know what? Let me play it a bit for you, all right? See, yeah, it's just this very, very wonderful song. And again, in the anime, when they're all singing it together, you know, all the characters, you know, they go to each character, and each character has a verse that they say. Da, 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 you know, see, I'm now getting into the song because again, it just has great lyrics. And again, all the characters singing it is great. Of course, like as I was trying to segue there. Horribly, mind you. I'm trying to segue into, you know, my favorite line lyric, you know. I've been to every moon I see. Da 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 da. I'm blanking on the lyrics and I apologize. And you know what? Funimation did a great job of doing an English version of the song, which I don't have on me. But yeah, it's really, really good. And that song just stands out pretty much as probably the second best musical piece behind the opening theme in this anime. Overall, the music is really good, outside of the closing theme, that is, which, again, is just substandard and average. But the rest of the music in the series is just spot on. It does exactly what it needs to do, and it's really, really good. With that, let's move on to animation. And let's talk about the overall style of Cat Bunny Cuties. You know, the overall style is, again, a very clean, crisp animation style. Very nice line work. And you just bold and bright colors. You know, this is just a bright anime. You know, this was an anime made for HD. Yeah, this anime is basically made, and just especially when you see that opening theme, just the different colors that are used, and it, the colors in the anime are bold, they're bright. You know, when dark colors are used, and there's, you know, situations where they're like at night or everything, you know, it's very dark, but you know, it's used to a sort of proper comeuppance, to put it in a way. You know, it's used properly, and it works really well. But there's never this feeling of sort of boldness, because that's really the main theme. There's a lot of brightness, but like I said, in the dark sort of scenes, it's dark. But at no time do they lose the boldness that this anime has. And that's overall how I think I can look at the style. There's a boldness to the animation quality. Not sort of bold as in sort of that the bold font, but, you know, they know what they want for their animation style, and they pretty much stick with it. And it just, it's bold in the sense that it hits you in the face. You know what type of anime, you know the anime you're watching when you see these character designs. You know it's Cat Planet Cuties or Bombshells in the Sky, whichever title you want to use. But the character designs are done really, really well. And as we move on to character designs, part of that is, again, the character designs aren't anything new. They're sort of classic, the classic idea of doing these characters. But they just do them so well, and there's a brightness and a boldness to the that they put into the characters, in the design and the acting and everything, that makes them stand out. Now, Kyo is pretty much the classic sort of standard, you know, because not only is this sort of an ecchi, fan service, comedy, action anime, it's also to an extent a harem anime as well. And he is pretty much that classic male lead, as far as design is concerned. You know, he has sort of the racial affair. He has a very sort of shoujo boy look about him. But, you know, again, wearing glasses and everything. And I like his design. He has a very down-to-earth design that I really, really love. Eris and the Catarians, they're everything you expect cat girl cuties to be. You know, Eris is sort of the perfect middle. Because really, there's five main Catarians you see. There's the captain and the doctor, who herself is played in a very Spock-like manner, which is supposed to be a reference to Spock. The way, again, this is sort of how the fan service is done in this show, and again, we'll get more into this later. But yeah, how a character acts is supposed to reference something. But yeah, the doctor and the captain are very sort of the classic big boob girls, and then you have like a security officer and sort of second in command that are sort of the very classic Japanese small chest girls, and then Eris is sort of in between both of them. She has a big chest, but kind of small. Well, not small. She's more towards the captain and the doctor, I guess. But you know, either way, the sort of classic sort of sexy girl designs. Which, again, I hate using that word sexy. Not because they aren't, but again, so many people want to take that word and twist it around into something awful. So it's one of the points where you can't use that word anymore. But you know what? Sort of the classic sexy girl design. But again, like Kyo, bright, bold, and how they portray the characters goes a long way in making those designs work. Moving on to Ai and Minami. And again, another thing is I love the color schemes. And this is a perfect segue to go into Ai and Minami. You know, Eris, I love her color scheme. I love the red and white. And I love sort of the base white aspect of the Catarian's clothes. And then the different colors, you know, like the grunts have sort of green colors. But, you know, all the rest, you know, the officers and that stuff, their individuality comes out in their own colors that sort of represent who they are. You know, the captain has sort of a royal purple, you know, very regal in her command. The security officer, very bright, cheery and everything, and cheerful. Sort of has a sky blue. I'm trying to remember what the doctor has. I think she's just a darker blue, because, like I said, she's very Spock-like. The second command sort of has, I want to say, an orange and everything. But when Ari and Minami, again, I also like the color schemes. You know, again, Ari being more of the classic Japanese type of beauty, with, you know, sort of the small chest, and, you know, but, you know, beautiful on her own. But again, the long black hair, and it creates a perfect contrast to Manami, who sort of has a short sort of orange bright hair, big chat and everything. I'm trying to remember, because there's almost a Thelma and Louise type of feeling between Aoi and Manami, which I think is intentional, and again, supposed to be a reference. There's so much pop culture references in this anime. It's even in the designs. And here, you know, again, there's this very Thelma and Louise, not Ruiz, but Louise, type of feel. There's maybe another, because that's the closest I think I can think of it, but I think there's like something, but definitely sort of the buddy cop type of comedy feel to the two characters. That, and that's why I'm saying I have a problem just saying Thelma and Louise, because again, those were, you know, robbers and everything, and it was much more of, they were much more played as sort of buddy cop-like. So, yeah, it just that overall feel, and sort of the designs of the two characters perfectly complemented each other. Janice, who is really the only villain, and for that matter, the Dogarians, again, I love, there's the earthy tones in their colors. Again, Dog Girls, it's exactly what you expect. She's made sexy, but again, she's very, made very sort of military-esque like. She's really not played for fan service whatsoever. You know, but she seems, her design just seems very sort of rough. And it's rough being rough. Rough? I couldn't resist the joke. But again, she had the dark brown colors, very earthy tones, and it makes the character design work. And then the other characters, you know, there's sort of the teacher that, you know, is in charge of the movie making club, sort of the sci-fi club, who also works for a government agency, which is very funny. There's this government agency that, you know, called Beautiful Contact, to insist that their first alien contacts have to be a certain way, and she can't get over that she's an alien. She just, you know, she's, aliens have to be, you know, big, sort of the classic-looking alien. Again, a nod to sort of pop culture references about what aliens are supposed to look at. Or look like, I should say. But yeah, it's, she's done really well. She has a very sort of maturity about her. Uncle is a very fun-looking character with sort of the sunglasses and everything. Jack, as I mentioned before, sort of that classic sort of Texan girl look with the big boobs and the halter top and the cowboy hat. And again, driving a Corvette Chevrolet Stingray. Awesome car. Actually, Aoi drives an awesome car as well, as I look it up. She drives a Ford Shelby GT500. You know what? That actually brings up a good feeling of what I was trying to maybe think of earlier. Maybe a better way to put it is sort of a Dukes of... I'm trying to think of this show. Not Dukes of Hazzard. But there was a show, a sort of a 70s sort of show that like took place in San Francisco. I'm sure somebody's going to send me a letter, hopefully reminding me of who I'm trying to think of, or leave me a comment. Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson did a horrible remake of the television show like a couple years ago. I can't remember it, but it's like, Aoi and Manami, they're sort of in that. That's what they're very much like. Especially with Aoi driving the sort of GT, the Ford Shelby GT500. But yeah, with Jack and Corvette, they also eat a lot at AMW. American Foods. It's exactly like how, you know, Pizza Hut is used in Code Geass. And they keep ordering from Pizza Hut. Because, you know, they got that $10 deal. But here, they go to AMW, they get hot dogs, hamburgers, and root beer. but, yeah, sort of that, her look is the sort of classic sort of the sort of classic stereotype of what Japanese think of American women look like. Which I'm sure, hear me say that, is pissing off Donovan I was about to say Donovan McNabb. Why would Donovan McNabb hear him? No, but I'm sure he's also glad I probably confused his name with a great athlete, but Donovan Morgan Grant is somewhere cursing the Japanese for doing a stereotype of American women. Hi, Don! With that, let's move on to the fight animation. Because there are some fights, and primarily they're gun fights and they're spaceship fights. All the animation is done really well. Again, the gunfights themselves, they're played out like sort of classic sort of gunfights from like classic television shows, you know? Like Miami Vice. There's even a Miami Vice like scene, you know, there's an episode where they have to rescue Ares and Kyo from the cult-like cat, I'm mixing myself up here, but there's a cult that sort of, a religious cult, mind you, that sort of looks at cats as, you know, we should have been more cat-like instead of being evolved from apes, which I'm making things a lot more confusing than they really should be, but anyways. Yeah, and so they gotta save him, so they gotta put on these horrible, horrible swimsuits, and it just makes the scene fun, because they're pink, and I think always just like light blue or whatever, but it's like, no, it's yellow, and it's so stereotypical, but it's all done in fun, and it's absolutely hilarious, and absolutely ridiculous, and the absurdity of them having to wear those suits. By this B-action movie director, who you would think somebody who is, and they show him as flaming gay. He's this big, he's the type of guy that if you go to a neighborhood of ill repute at midnight, he's that guy that's so obviously a guy who thinks he's a woman, who tries to convince you to pick him up for $500. That's the guy who's the action. Oh, it is hilarious. Again, we'll talk about this more later. I have to get off this. But anyways, so they attack this big ocean liner in a Miami Vice speedboat. They even make a joke that, like, you have a boat that's like the one from Miami Vice, don't you? With guns and everything. Yeah. It's, I'm trying to hold off on talking about pop culture stuff. I really am. But yeah, the fight animation is wonderful. And the speed things up here, special effects and background, all of it is wonderful. The special effects are wonderful. The, you know, weather effects and stuff like that, and explosions and dust and everything. Again, like I said, this was a show made for HD. And the same could be said for backgrounds. The backgrounds are beautiful. The Oak Mountain background and the view of the ocean and the neighborhood. Everything feels inviting. And, you know, no matter where they are in the anime, I want to explore that area. You know, it's just so fun and everything. And it's wonderful, wonderful creative ideas on the backgrounds. So, animation-wise, like I said, I love everything about this anime. And I love everything about the animation. With that, I'm going to try to compose myself a little bit and breathe in and breathe out. While I do that, we're going to take a break. I'm going to play a couple promos for you for the usual cast of suspects. A wonderful podcast that you should be listening to. And when we come back, we're going to get into acting and story. So I'll be right back, folks.
The funeral is over. Jonathan Kent is on the mend.
So, how's Clark's father?
Oh, much, much better.
Lois has returned home.
Lois, over here!
Harry, wife? Since when did you start meeting your staff at the airport? How'd you know I was returning on that flight?
A good editor checks out his hunches, Lois. I got a hot story I want you on straight away. I'm parked over here.
But just as Metropolis has learned to live without the Man of Steel...
I know, there was only one Superman, but Metropolis just hit the jackpot. Because we got four Supermen now, and nobody knows which of them, if any, is the real McCoy.
Four beings of incredible power and intellect have laid claim to the Man of Steel's name.
The last son of Krypton.
I live.
The Man of Steel.
Man of Steel coming through! Nobody move! This is a bust!
The Cyborg.
Yes, I'm Superman. I'm back.
The Boy of Steel.
Put me down!
Listen, pal, don't ever call me Superboy. Capiche?
The reign of the Superman is upon us. And so, from crisis to crisis, a Superman podcast begins its epic coverage of this last act in the epic Death and Return of Superman saga. Every week, Michael Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor, along with the best and the brightest in the podcasting community, will cover this event in all of its forms, from the comics to the novelizations to the audio drama and beyond. Superman is back, but is any of them the real Man of Steel? Find out on From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, located at www.supermanhomepage.com and www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
I guess you weren't so tough after all, were you? Now it's time to send you to the next dimension.
291 original episodes.
This can't be. It's still going up.
325 manga chapters.
You act innocent, but you're deadly.
Time to die!
Dozens of characters, hundreds of enemies, and a whole lot of violence.
That kind of violence is pointless.
You see, Super Saiyans tend to be a bit violent.
Oh, crap!
Join hosts Donovan and Jesse as they cover the arrival of the Saiyans, the journey to Namek, the battle with Frieza, the mystery of the androids, and the terror of Majin Buu.
I lied when I said you could go. At least partially lied, for I will let you go to another dimension.
The Next Dimension, a Dragon Ball Z podcast. Join the fight at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com.
See ya.
In June of 1962, a superhero unlike any other made his first appearance in the pages of Amazing Fantasy number 15, the final issue of that series. 6 months later, this character would receive his own title, and from there he would grow in popularity and be adapted into several animated series, a handful of live-action series both in the U.S. and abroad, have countless action figures made in his likeness, dominate the cinema screen, and much, much more. It is fair to say that the Amazing Spider-Man is a pop culture icon and a fictional character that people all over the world identify with and love. This year, Spider-Man is turning 50, and Views from the Long Box, an internet radio series hosted by me, Michael Bailey, is going to celebrate the wall crawler in a series of episodes focusing on various aspects of the character's existence. Together with such podcasting luminaries as Brad Douglas, Andrew Leyland, John Wilson, and Scott Gardner, I'm going to give Spidey the biggest birthday card a comic fan could. He may not be my favorite character, but I like him a great deal, and he deserves the spotlight in this, his 50th year. Views from the Long Box can be found at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com. New episodes hit every Friday. Views from the Long Box is a Fortress of Bailey Tooth production in association with the DiMonzo Corps of Milan, Italy.
And welcome back. And let's get right into acting. There's really only one antagonist, so we'll get to her in a second. But let's start with the protagonist. Again, all the actors here did a wonderful, wonderful job. Aaron Dismuke, and I know I'm screwing up his name. But he did a wonderful job as Keo. And it, of course, it's also good to sort of hear that his voice has raised a bit since, you know, playing Al in Full Metal Alchemist, which I'm sure pisses off so many fangirls and makes them cry tears of pain and suffering, which sustained me. All joking aside, I feel bad for fangirls, but it was a funny thing. when they announced Full Metal Brotherhood, and they announced, well, Aaron's not gonna be Al anymore because, you know, he hit puberty. And I remember watching the sort of the Funimation panel where they announced this, and there was a fair girl that literally shouted out, "No!" I'm like, wow! Really? Yeah, he's still alive! He's not dead! He just happened to JoJo Boy voice! But you know what? It's really wonderful to see him come up. It's almost sort of a proud fatherly thing because sort of you've seen this kid grow up over the past 10 years as not only as a person but as an actor, because, you know, again, he started out as a little kid and now he's like a very older teenager. Like, I think he's like 18 or at least somewhere around there by now. He's 16, 17, 18, I think somewhere around there. And sort of to see him grow up as a person and as an actor, it's been a joy to see. And, you know, he does a great job as Keo. Tia Ballard does a great job bringing his very joyful sort of Aries. she's very funny. And again, one of the things I like is that, again, all these characters, yeah, they're sort of the, let's say, they're just classic stereotypical characters you'd have in an anime like this. But the way the actors play them, and sort of the story behind the characters, again, it's the event. It's not that the story necessarily needs to be anything other than a simple story, which is what it is, which we'll get the story. But it's about following the journey of the characters and about the actors making you want to follow the characters. And that's something that all of these actors do. None of these characters seem like stereotypes, even though at the end of the day, they are. That's because the actors and the story do a great job of making you understand that they're not stereotypes. They're designed based off stereotypes, but they're not stereotypes, if that makes any sense. Tia Ballard, yeah, she's not goofy or oblivious. She's very, very smart. But again, it's that sort of, I come from another culture, and we're a very happy culture. You know? Ali and Minami, again, they're very beautiful characters, but they're played smart. Again, Brittany Kowski and Monica Rial, I should say, do a wonderful job portraying those characters. So many, again, I keep calling it Thelma and Louise, and Starsky and Hutch, I knew at some point I was going to get the name of the show. But that is what Ali and Minami are played like. They're played very much like Starsky and Hutch. Okay? It's very obvious. It's just, I was blanking on the name. The entire time watching this series, I was actually blanking on the name of the series. Like, when you want to remember the name of something, you can't remember it. But that's how much they're very much played like. And they have this great buddy comedy routine rapport between the two characters. And a wonderful job by Monica Rial and Brittany Kowski. Now, I do have to add something. I've actually watched the Japanese version because I started watching this on Crunchyroll. So I actually watched this series twice. I watched the Japanese version of it and I watched the English version of it since I signed up for the Elite membership for Funimation. Both voice actings did a great job. And the Japanese side also had that Starsky and Hutch type of rapport too, and I think that was intentional to, again, be a pop culture reference. But yeah, I could watch another anime series spinoff where it's just Aoi and Minami on adventures. You know? Again, Minami being a gun otaku, Aoi being sort of the driver and everything like that. It's very, very fun. And even Lucy Christian, who, you know, becomes a friend again, she's the classic sort of goofy, childish millionaire who basically has maids who, you know, again, was never lived in the real world. But even that, she still seems smart. There are times where she does something that's obviously stupid, but at the same time, she still seems smart. These characters are never looked upon as just stereotypes. And a part of that goes to the way the actors portrayed them, and they did a great job portraying them. Really, the only villain in the series, or I should say antagonist, is Janna from the Dogarians, played by Colleen Klinkenbeard. And she, again, she's a really good actor. She does a great job with the character. There's another character along with her, Bump, but he's more to be talked about, again, when we get to fan service. And trust me, there's a reason I can't wait to get to fan service to talk about that one character, because that one character is an entire reference to another character. It's my favorite character in this anime, and you're going to die laughing when I talk about him. Anyways, but yeah, she does a great job portraying Janice, and again, she's evil, but she's not that all, like, pure evil. She's evil in the sort of sense you understand. You know, the Dogarians forced by the Galactic Alliance's, you know, laws where they've, you know, had embargoes put on them. They're forced to deal under the table. And so they're trying to protect what they feel is their territory. There's this very cat and dog type feel to their rivalry, which is intentional. It's done for comedy. And they do use a lot of puns. You know, the dog will have its day. You know, the Catarian's going, you know, let's use these dogs as a scratching post. Every pun you can think of is used here. And it's done perfectly because it fits the comedy and it makes you laugh. So just a great job by the entire acting cast, whether they be protagonists or antagonists. With that, let's move on to story. In the first part, we're going to talk about the adventure and sci-fi aspect of the main plot. Because, really, this is just it's a fan service show. It's a celebration of sort of pop culture. That doesn't mean that the plot is just so basic and useless. The plot is, it's a very simple plot. It's easy to follow. And it allows itself to be a vessel for this sort of celebration of cop culture. Again, it's every sort of classic sort of action buddy cop movie with aliens thrown in and everything. But at the same time, it never feels like an amalgamation. It feels like a solid story all the way through. I mean, it really is pretty basic. Ares comes, you know, she takes a liking to Kyo. And, you know, her and the Catarians are basically there to try to form diplomatic relations with Earth. The Dogarians don't want to form because they're making money selling technology to the governments of Earth. And if the Catarians come, that stops. Because, again, of the galactic embargo on them and, you know, again, competition. So there's a fight to try to drive the Catarians away so the Dogarians can hold that. There's many organizations trying to get it. And it's comedic timing and stuff like that. But again, just a very simple story. And again, there's really no overall theme or lesson other than, you know, these characters, when the time is needed, they step up and they succeed. This is just a fun comic. Really, the best way to put it is like a Starsky and Hutch, or a Duke of Hazzard, or a Beverly Hills Cop type of comedy. It's just a simple action-adventure comedy full of so many different fan services to celebrate pop culture. It's not just etchy fan service that is in this, and it's not just a harem. I mean, there's a harem-esque aspect to the anime, But it's minor. It's not a major part. There's ecchi in this, but it's not a major part. You know, again, the whole fan service part, there's so many different fan services, as we'll get to in a couple minutes. The plot is really simple, but that's all it needs to be. You know, if it didn't need to be this dark-themed plot, because then it wouldn't be fun. The whole point of this story is to be fun, to be playful. And it's very refreshing to see a series that knows what it is, and instead of trying to be something it isn't, and this is really what was the problem with anime from 2005 to 2009. Again, it was trying to be something it wasn't. We have to be dark and brooding because people love it dark and brooding. Instead of trying to be itself, this anime was itself. It knew what it was. We're bright, we're playful, we're funny, and that's what we're going to be. And that's why the adventure and the sci-fi aspect of this plot works. Because it is. It's very playful. It knows you know what the story is. But there's a belief in the story that makes it work. Again, that goes right into the next point, which is the main aspects of, you know, each character. You know, Kyo, like I said, again, that down-to-earth personality. You know, he's never played as a stumbling fool as so many. Like I said, in 2005 to 2009, sort of the ecchi anime, the typical ecchi anime character was of this bumbling goofball who we considered a pervert, even though he would stumble into things, but he had no courage. You know, Kyo is played as a sort of a pretty headstrong, pretty smart character. He does get caught in situations, but he does try to stand up for himself. And he does have a confidence in himself. You know, he never doubts himself. He had sort of somewhat obliviousness that some guys would have, but it's done the comedic event. You know, you got him just wanting to be with his friends, enjoying life, enjoying shooting movies. He's a very sort of laid-back, down-to-earth guy. It's what leads the other girls to being, you know, attracted to him. You know, Aries, who's the playful soul, she's attracted to Kyo in the sense that, again, he's just this, to an extent, accepting of her. And always willing to help her. It sort of attracts her to him. And, you know, she has she's a very deep thinker. But, you know, again, that sort of personality, that very cheerful, very sort of cat-like personality. And again, the Katarians sort of have these sort of cat-like personalities of wanting to be with people. And then, of course, Aoi and Minami, again, sort of that love, you know, wanting to be with Kyo because they really are attracted to him. And again, each of the characters, it adds a bit of depth to this very basic story. But again, it's all done in fun. It's all done playfully. Again, it's a series that knows what it is. And I'm really going to get off that because I really want to talk about the fan service. This is what I've been wanting to talk about. I'm really starting to think that maybe I should start off reviews talking about the story. Because I'm like rushing through other stuff to talk about story. It's kind of this. I know why I leave story for last. Because it's the same reason why I leave, like, the main entree on a dish for dinner last. And I'll have macaroni and cheese, rice, and a steak. I'll eat the rice and the macaroni first and leave the steak for last all the time. Because it's the main entree, the main dish, and I want to have it. Same thing here. Story's the main dish, and I'm getting way off frickin' track. So thank you for joining me on this rant. But, yeah. Oh my god, like I said, this is a celebration of pop culture. It's what this anime is. And yeah, they have ecchi moments that are there for titillation. But at the same point, they're not suffocating the anime. As animes from 2005 to 2009 would do. They're in there. But most of the fan service in this show is pop culture references. You know, Aoi driving a Ford Shelby GT500. Jack driving a Corvette, driving a Corvette Stingray. And I'm kind of like, you know, what is it called it earlier, so I apologize. The different guns, you know, they're a point where they're in a simulation, and Minami says, I want to use a mini gun. It's this big sort of gun. And, like, we didn't need to know. You know, again, them, you know, they're in Shinjuku, and they're at the sort of famous anime mall, and, you know, there's a gun replica, and, oh, God, it's a replica of a gun. Oh, God, I'd love to have it. Them showing how to basically reload a revolver. Because they use revolvers in this shit. They don't use, like, Desert Eagles and that stuff, but they use tons of different guns. References like that to guns, to cars. But again, most of all, the reference to especially American sci-fi pop culture. You know, each and every show starts off with what is really sort of a parody of sort of the classic Star Trek opening. You know, these are the adventures of the Catarians. To boldly go where no Catarian, or just not boldly, but to, we're on a such and such year journey to discover and explore new worlds. To boldly go where no sexy cat girl has gone before. Which is what they actually use, and it's funny and hilarious. And like I said, the Doctor, you know, is played in a very Spock-like manner. You know, because everything is, you know, very technical and logical. Everything, you know, takes everything from a very logical vantage point. like I said, the Miami Vice, yeah, again, they're in these, like, hilarious and just, oh my God, how could you put girls in those bathing suits? You know, and you know what type of, you know, sort of the string V-thongs and stuff like that. And, but at the same time, it's very Miami Vice-like. Because that whole action scene is a very Miami Vice-like scene with them in the Miami Vice boat. Them in swimsuits that you pretty much only find on Miami Beach. Like, the skimpiest swimsuits you could ever think of. It all, you know, the flaming gay guy, who I find absolutely hilarious. I know there's, like, other reference. I know there's, like, some type of anime, 70s anime, space battle anime that's referenced in the last episode on the platforms that Aoi, Ares, and Minami fly. Because I like, there's one I'm saving for that. I mean, I've talked about AMW and it constantly showing up. In the movie club room, there are all these posters that are supposed to be basically parodies of sort of action movies. Like, there's a poster of Armageddon in the background. There's another poster that, I've completely forgotten what it is, but it's like, it was a movie, like, oh my God, they have a poster referencing that movie? Really? Really? But I do remember that one of them is a poster that's supposed to be a take on the Armageddon poster, you know, with Bruce Willis. Thankfully, no asteroids are in this anime with Bruce Willis on it. But, yeah, but like, the biggest reference and my most favorite reference is a character. Janice, the Dogarian, has a sidekick. A Dogarian assistroid, again, looks like a dog. But this assistroid has sort of a Shaw and sort of what looks like sort of a World War I flying cap. This character, all he does, well, he answers by a computer screen, but pretty much his only lines is to snicker like this. The character's name is Matley. This entire character is nothing but a reference to Muttley from the Way Out Wacky Races of Hanna-Barbera. That is my favorite character in this series. I freaking love Muttley. And when I saw him sticker for the first time, when I first watched this, I'm like, holy shit. That's freaking Muttley. Oh my god! They created a character to reference Muttley from the Way Out Wacky Races! I love this director! I love this creator! He is freaking awesome! to reference the Way Out Wacky Races, which is one of my favorite Hanna-Barbera cartoons of all time. I love Yogi, I love Scooby-Doo, I love tons of Hanna-Barbera, and you might be hearing more about Hanna-Barbera in a couple weeks, so stay tuned. But to an entire day... do an entire character to reference a character that, let's be honest, probably most Japanese would have to look up to understand. I give major props to. It's freaking awesome. I love this anime. It's freaking Muttley. I'm completely biased on this anime just because there is a character that references Muttley from Way Out Wacky Races, and I'm not ashamed to admit it. Oh, I'm losing my mind here. But yet, the fans, it just, the entire show is just a celebration of pop culture. You know, I just probably listed my favorite references and the one I can remember. There are probably ones I'm forgetting. It's just a joy to watch. And it's... the sisteroids, you know... Aoi's sisteroids look like... Manami and Kyo and... Aoi are given the sisteroids. And they get clothes and stuff to sort of match their master's sort of style. You know, Kyo's looks like a director. Aoi's are sort of dressed like samurais from Akira Kurosawa films. Manami's sisteroid has like a business suit, a tie, and sunglasses. Is named Yun Fat. And it's basically a reference to Chow Yun Fat, the action movie star. In fact, that aforementioned Miami Vice boat scene, the way they break into the ocean liner where Aries and Kyo are being kept by the underside of the cat's paw cult. That's the name of the cult, which is why I was sort of stumbling over it earlier. They have to build a hole, and they have sort of these antimatter bullets that only destroy non-organic matter, and her sisteroid, Yun Fat, is firing it, and when he pulls out his guns to fire, these four doves appear, and they appear to be flying alongside him. Again, references to Chow Yun Fat movies that, you know, he did with John Woo. That is brilliant. Again, if you are a fan of pop culture like I am and know all this stuff, you will love this anime just to see all the pop culture references. Which again brings us to having more the final point, which is serious talk, as we're doing all month, about ecchi. And the really sad part is, there is a ton, unfortunately, of fans, said aforementioned fans, as I talked about in Ikitosan, who will only talk about the scenes of so-called titillation. Well, why were they there? If they're not important, why were they there? And there's no answer I can give that will satisfy them. And it's really sad, is that here's this very fun, very joyful anime. And instead of sitting down and enjoying it for what it is, again, people grasping for straws to try to make themselves feel like they're doing something good. And it's really sad that these people have no confidence in themselves. That they don't allow themselves to sit down and enjoy an anime. This is a fun anime. And unfortunately, there are just going to be people that all they're going to notice about the show is that it has ecchi in front of it and that there are scenes of titillation. I mean, they're just supposed to be fun fan service scenes. That's all they are. And, you know, they're cute cat girls. They're naked. Yes, they're played specifically towards ecchi fans. Nobody cared. Nobody made a big deal about it. In fact, this is one of the few shows where I will rather watch the censored version of this show than the uncensored. Why? Because I love brilliant censoring. And it's hilarious. And it's something that was done in 2010 with a lot of ecchi shows that made it brilliant. You know, in Higher Rider and Samurai Girl, they did it where there were drops. You know, they used the sort of the art style of the sort of classic Japanese painting with the ink to integrate into the censoring. It was brilliant. And here, whenever there's a scene where, you know, there would be boobies on screen, the little cat assistants would show up with signs blocking it, saying, "Sorry, this is off limits." And it was cute. By the way, the cat assistants are absolutely adorable. Oh, I want one of my own. I haven't said it already. But, yeah. They'll show up and all cute like this. And it's hilarious. I mean, me and 132 Productions did the same thing. I need to calm down. I'm getting so riled up. But me and Chris Statton and Gene Marquez, when they came down to Florida, when I was living in Florida, to go to the inaugural year of ShadowCon, which had the Nostalgia Critic, and we invited the Nostalgia Critic and his brother Rob, and we did a riff on The Room. You know, Tommy Wiseau, you know, "Oh, hi, critic." Yeah, that room. But, you know, we had to censor. There were a couple scenes of nudity, and we had to censor it. Well, Chris came up with the great idea, well, let's use boobies. And when we say boobies, there's a bird known as the blue-footed booby. There are these seabirds, and they have blue-webbed feet. And so, like, for instance, the very first scene of nudity is Tommy Wiseau's naked ass, which why anybody would want to see his naked ass, walking down a hallway. So we put these blue boobies there. It was hysterical. Everybody loved it and laughed. And it was funny. Boobies! It's boobies! And you don't see the boobies, you see the bird, which are known as boobies. It's hilarious. If you don't laugh at that, you don't have a soul. You don't have a soul. This series, at the end of the day, is wonderful. Yeah, there are scenes of titillation and it's edgy, but again, it's all done playfully, it's all done fun, and you know what? There's not a female character that isn't played smart, that isn't made to look independent, and they're sexy, but they're not symbols. Anybody who looks at this and thinks otherwise obviously is not watching this anime. And that's not a matter of somebody can't have an opinion where they think they're sex symbols. That's just a matter of fact. How anybody can sit there, watch this show, and only notice that? They're not watching this show. Because there is so much more going on in this show than really the one or two scenes in maybe an episode that are played for titillation. I mean, they do have sort of the romantic comedy aspect, but they're not always naked. There's maybe one or two scenes an episode because it is an edgy anime. But, you know, there's tons of fan service, tons of references. I've watched this show so many times and I'm still discovering new references. At the end of the day, this is a great show. And is very representative of why 2010 was the year where anime rebounded and came back. I think this show would be great on Toonami. I wish the anime companies would get together and find a way to start promote anime again and promote this title, because this is a wonderful title and I guarantee you Americans would love this title. End of the day, Cat Planet Cuties gets a 5 out of 5 from me. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed it. As we passed the one-hour mark a couple minutes ago, but yeah, I really got into my rants there because I love all the references in this show. Remember, if you have any comments you want to leave about the show, there are several ways you can do it. One, you can leave us an email at absolution132@yahoo.com. That's absolution132@yahoo.com. You can also leave us a message on our Facebook page, which you can find by going to Facebook and searching out the Absolution Network. Like us and leave us a message. And of course, you can always leave a comment on the site, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. Of course, at the site, make sure you also check out the Otaku Momentum there. And also, while you're there, check out all the other 132 Productions sites, which include Random Bear Box Reviews by Chris Stanton, of course, Mean Gene's new anime site, and of course, my other podcast and sites, which includes Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast, where I review every Godzilla movie ever made. You can find that at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And of course, my Comic Book Crazy podcast and site, which has a few podcasts like Hexcast, Comic Book Pitch, and of course, the aforementioned Comic Book Crazy. You can find that at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And of course, while you're there, check out the sidebar of our site where you can find all of our friends who do wonderful podcasts. This, of course, includes Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box, and of course, from Crisis to Crisis that he does with Jeffrey Taylor. Though on Views from the Long Box, this latest episode is out, and it includes the return of the semi-regular co-host, Shag, the irredeemable one himself. And it's a 2-hour episode. It's wonderful. But yeah, check them out. Brad Douglas's Spider-Man Crawl Space, Steven Schleicher's Major Spoilers podcast, and of course, Scott Gardner's 2 True Freaks, along with many others. So, that is it for this episode. Next week, we finish off Etchy Month, and what a better way to finish off Etchy Month with a anime that, well, if you thought I was highly excited this week in talking about references, we're going to cover one of my top 3 animes of all time. Now, I've already covered 2 of them. That means number 3. I've covered Gundam Wing. I've covered Collider Star. So what's number 3? Well, obviously it's an Etchy title. It's a 6-episode series, and it is one of the greatest series of all time. It's one of the greatest animes of all time, as far as I'm concerned. It is a hilarious anime that time after time after time, I've done viewing parties with mixed crowds, fangirls, yaoi fangirls, of, you know, people of all different types. And more importantly, I show one episode, episode 5, and people laugh hysterically because it is one of the funniest animes ever. I am, of course, talking about Kentaro Oe and his journey to study. I like to study. I like to learn and live about. That's right. Next week, we get Golden as we cover Golden Boy. So, until next time, my Tsunami Generation, stay golden.
A cursed samurai. You have succeeded again.
Listening to the Toonami Black Hole Megamix. by DJ Clark Nova. Don't sleep on it.